Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. The boreal forest is one giant laboratory for researchers interested in forest ecology. The big push now is to take the scientific research being done and apply it so that industries can work more sustainably in the forest. One of the questions Dr. Fiona Schmigelow is trying to answer for the Sustainable Forest Management Network is how do we find thresholds that define biological health? And new sources of power. Researchers Daniel Kwok and Larry Kostyuk have turned things down a few notches. No megawatts for them. Their work on the micro scale has helped them discover something others have been trying to find for decades, and that's a new way to generate electricity. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Over the last decade, the interest in forest research has exploded. The Sustainable Forest Management Network, for example, has supported hundreds of projects. But one of the biggest challenges facing the scientific community is taking all this newfound knowledge and shaping it into some practical guidelines for industries working in the forest. University of Alberta ecologist Dr. Fiona Schmigelow is one of those scientists involved in the synthesis exercise undertaken by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Her job is to look at how we might determine biological thresholds that signal ecological health or demise.
Well, we're interested in thresholds because thresholds essentially are trying to quantify or describe a nonlinear response of organisms, some measure of organisms, to the amount of habitat in a given area. If it's a linear response, which we expect, that's been well documented for a long time, then it gives us a lot of sort of predictive ability as to what we can expect over time with changes in landscapes. When there are nonlinear responses, it means that there are more rapid changes in species response relative to changes in amount of habitat, and that is cause for concern potentially from a management perspective because it increases our uncertainty about the outcome of management.
What are the problems then in defining what a threshold actually is? Because you're looking at so many different species and they all have so many different needs.
That's very true, and that's why there's actually been a lot of confusion around these concepts. I think one has to be very explicit about management objectives. And if the species of greatest concern are those that are most at risk, which is what some people would argue would, is the most appropriate way to go, then the priority should be on quantifying thresholds for those species and making sure that you're accounting for their requirements. It's somewhat analogous to, what people refer to as an umbrella species approach, I suppose, in that if you're taking care of the thresholds, habitat thresholds, requirements for habitat for the most sensitive species, then you hope that other species are coming along with that. Now, it's very dangerous in just choosing one or two species. You certainly need to choose a suite of species with different habitat requirements or even groups of similar species to try and capture the range of variation out there. But it's a complex issue, and forest management is complex, and I think we do it a disservice by trying to oversimplify it.
When you look at this idea of varying thresholds, how do you incorporate that into management? Because when you look at the forest and how logs are being cut, you're looking at things at a stand level, and you're also looking at the other extreme, the landscape. How do you bring all that together?
Well, this is an issue that permeates forest management overall when we start to look at alternative values. And I would say that, one of the fundamental problems with current forest management is this notion of sustained yield on a fixed spatial extent. And a lot of people who are far more knowledgeable about that from a forestry perspective have, also been critical of that concept, that we're placing too much constraints on how we acquire our wood by having these sort of arbitrary boundaries that are defined by forest management units or forest management agreements or quotas that, were never designed to address these many other values that we now expect our forest to provide or maintain. How I think we start getting beyond that is that we have to somehow be able to communicate, well, first quantify and then communicate the need to be thinking not just about space in a fixed sort of construct, but also how boy, can I even communicate this? How the spatial arrangement and amount of habitats changes over time, and how that has influenced the patterns that we now observe, how those are likely to be affected by current forest management practices. And that's not just forestry activities. When I talk about forest management, I mean all the sorts of activities going on in forested landscapes. In Alberta, that means gas and oil and agriculture and everything else. And it's very nice for people to sort of, you know, be able to manage to fixed notions that are static in time. But really, these are highly dynamic systems historically. And if we really want to be talking about applying a natural disturbance model, then I think we need to be much more creative in how we conceptualize that and apply it within a forest management context.
You showed a rather interesting slide in your presentation where you could take the different areas that are left, and this ties into the leaving the variable retention on the land. But it could be in large clumps or it could be in little bitty clumps spread all over the place. How do you decide what's going to be best?
Well, those are the sorts of things that we need to collect more information on. There has been some very good work at the stand level on the amount and distribution of residuals, and there have been a couple of presentations in this forum related to that. But where we really are lacking in information is what's happening at a larger scale with the sort of spatial distribution of those certain focal habitat types. In that case, maybe we can talk about old forest as being, you know, a particular habitat type that's at risk due to various forest management activities that we expect will decline over time. And so getting a better handle on what the existing patterns are and how they relate to species responses and how those might change over time then provides us with some tools to evaluate alternative forest management strategies and hopefully to come up with things that balance various values.
What are the challenges for you now in assessing where you go with thresholds, the type of research that should be done so that it can translate into better management for forest companies?
We can learn something about, you know, by looking at other jurisdictions, to some extent in Canada, but more so in boreal forests in Finland and Sweden, and start documenting how those have changed over time to relative to where we are now, and start building some of those relationships and trajectories and giving us more information for decisions. But I think we also need to do some fairly hard thinking about these issues and thinking about the sensitive species and looking at issues of regional persistence of those sensitive species, primarily in a modeling framework, because I don't think we can collect the data necessary initially, but I think we can build models that will help reduce our uncertainty about how sensitive species may respond over time, what patterns we would expect, and then we can go out and test some of those assumptions or, you know, nail down some of the values that are very sensitive within those modeling frameworks.
Since the landscape has changed a fair bit over the years, can we look back in time?
We can look at the forest over time because we have reasonably good data on that. But what we don't have are the associated sort of biotic data on species response. And unfortunately, because of, you know, for the boreal, large parts of it have only become accessible in the last few years, so there aren't good long-term databases. There are very few exceptions to that, actually. We've got some databases now that go back maybe 10 or 15 years, but that's not very long in terms of looking at species responses. There have been attempts to assemble those sorts of response curves for caribou, and they're now using essentially threshold values derived from those analyses to build caribou management plans in Alberta. And we're looking at doing similar things for some birds and some other species. People have looked at opportunities to use historic trapline data and possibly even First Nations traditional ecological knowledge. Those are probably the longest history databases, but I'm certainly not well qualified to know how to use those. But people are, researchers are starting to become more interested and more knowledgeable and better at engaging First Nations communities, I think, in trying to tap into that sort of wealth of historic knowledge. And I think there are, some real opportunities there. But again, sort of harping back to an earlier point, in Finland and Sweden, they have some databases on species distributions that go back 100 years, because they have a long history of land use management, a long history of active participation by volunteers in things like breeding bird surveys, in walking triangle transects for fur bearers and other species of interest, ungulates, you know, moose and things like that. So they've actually got those long-term databases and are able to build some of those relationships. And I think how we can use that is to look at those relationships and look at the trajectories relative to land use history and see if some of the patterns we've got now are falling, you know, about in line with where we would expect them to be. And then that gives us essentially a point for extrapolating things and perhaps building some better expectations and better sampling designs for tackling these things in the future.
Thank you very much, Fiona.
Thanks, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Fiona Schmigelow, an associate professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta, and she's a researcher engaged by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. It was a casual conversation between two curious minds that sparked a very bright idea and led to the discovery of a new way to make electricity. When University of Alberta professors Daniel Kwok and Larry Kostyuk published their research paper a few months ago, they garnered the attention of people around the world. Their big news on the scientific front was really based on something very small, and that's the electric current that can be generated by pushing little streams of water through tiny channels. I caught up with Daniel Kwok at a reception hosted by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, one of his research sponsors.
Well, what we have done is we have found a new way of converting electricity from one means to another without any moving parts.
How significant is that?
Well, the impact is that, I mean, nobody really have ever found a new ways of generating electricity for nearly over 100 years. And this is by collaboration with Professor Castile together. It came as a surprise to us that after talking from different disciplines, we came with the idea of using it.
How long had you been working on this problem?
We have been working on this problem only for 1 year. But the background of this phenomenon has been for a number of years already.
So what is it that you did that really sparked you to keep working on it?
There are a lot of problems that a lot of understanding are still not known in the phenomenon that I really want to understand. We want to find out the answers to many of these questions. And this is basically my pushing force.
Can you give me an example?
Like the physics of the phenomena at a micro or nano scale, meaning 1,000 times or less smaller than the size of a human hair, is still not understanding when I have fluid being pushed into these tiny channels. And you mean how the ions behave in the liquid, how the water ions behave when this is in touch with the wall. All these problems are still not known.
Did you feel that you were getting anywhere with it, or were you just sort of up against a wall?
Well, we're trying hard to understand, but at least by our experience, we have built a prototype that we can make use of this phenomena to get some current that is power out of the devices. We still have to do more in terms of optimizing the device and understanding the phenomena.
How far away are you from turning in this into something that could be a product that people could buy?
Well, I would say a number of years. Right now, we can use it to power very small device that takes little powers, like LED device, light emitting diodes, or even if we can make it right, cell phone, very tiny one, it will work. Okay, it really depends on the device that you want to operate.
The other person involved in this is Larry Kostyuk, yes. And the two of you just really approached this from totally different perspectives. Mm-hmm. When you met him and you started talking about it, what happened?
Well, when I met him, I was trying to tell him or trying to explain to him that, when I have liquid flowing through these tiny little channels, what happened to the charge separation? I can basically get a small current and voltage out of this. And he was, really? You go, and then I said, yeah. And then from his point of view, because he has a background of energy, from his point of view, this is really exciting. Because one can basically push liquid into channels to get some power out. And he sees this as something very different. So from the different point of view, then we basically got talking together, working together for a few months, and we basically got something to work with.
When you say that you were only working on this for a year, that's actually pretty fast for something like this to happen when people had been working on it for a very long time before.
Yeah, actually, we were quite lucky about that. We got very good graduate students, and because we have been working on this for a number of years as a background research, that we pretty much know the physics of the phenomena, but now working for a few months in order to apply this phenomena to drive devices.
Since the article was published and you've had all the flurry of media attention, what's happening now?
Well, now I still go back to the lab and, you know, I still teach, I still do research and focus on what I want to do. But I've still been getting a lot of media attention and topics emailing me about how excited they feel about the invention and how environmentally friendly they like the idea would be.
What part has Alberta Ingenuity played?
Alberta Ingenuity has been very supportive to me because I've been here only for a few years as a new faculty. Since a few years, and they have been really supportive into my research about supporting my establishment of my lab. Very generous funding. They have been very supportive to my students. They've been supporting at least 5 or 6 students into my lab. And currently I'm supervising like 16 graduate students. So they're really helpful.
Congratulations and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Daniel Kwok, who holds a Canada Research Chair in Mechanical Engineering at the University of Alberta. The other partner in the discovery of this new way to generate electricity is Dr. Larry Kostyuk. Larry is a professor and chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Alberta.
What we've been working on is a means of generating electricity where we tap into a phenomena that's been sort of ignored or not certainly exploited very much that uses electrokinetic phenomena. This is a naturally occurring phenomena where when you bring a liquid and solid together, you get a small charge on a surface. And then we exploit that to produce electricity.
How is it that it was ignored for so long?
I think it has to do with the fact that the amount of power that's produced from these devices is relatively small. And I think the last serious time it was looked at was in the late 1950s, early 1960s. In that time, people weren't interested in really small power sources. Crucial inventions like the transistor hadn't been invented yet, so we didn't have small microelectronic devices at the time. And I think it was through that we were looking for power sources that were in the megawatts as opposed to the microwatts that the attention just drifted away from these kinds of systems.
Are you at the point then where you can begin to apply this?
I don't think we're quite at that stage yet. I think what we're doing now is in order to use an energy conversion system, a power or electrical generation system, you need to understand its various characteristics, what voltages would be available to you, at what currents, so that you can start thinking about where its the applications might come, where it might be best suited for its use in industry or in society. It's just that information that we're collecting right now. I think in the original paper we showed that it was possible. We showed that this is something that could be done relatively simply, and there was natural materials that allowed us to tap into this phenomena. What we're doing now is we're doing this more broad characterization so that if people have a need for the kind of power that these systems can produce, we can provide them with the information of what voltages and currents will be available to them.
Do you have any idea what could the applications be?
Oh, we've ended up in various levels of discussion with people, and the topic has ranged from systems that are sometimes described as having black start capabilities without any other work or external energy source. You can, by forcing a liquid like water through some small channels, you can produce electricity, you know, in a freestanding from nothing situation. And that interests some people for various applications, maybe in a remote sensing situation where people would need power, where you can't get it from the normal electrical grid. There's also been discussion about using it on small microelectronic mechanical systems, these MEMS devices, where you need only small amounts of power. And I think that's the direction that it will probably be going. I can't see it being a device that will, you know, generate electricity to power a city or something like that. It's just not on that sort of scale.
You collaborated with Dr. Daniel Kwok. How did the two of you get together?
That resulted from myself being on sabbatical and also not a person who was fully involved in the department and all the other sort of members of our department. I accepted the position of becoming chair of our department and while I was on sabbatical. And on my return, I took the time to go around and visit all the different academics who had recently joined the department and people who had been here for years, but I didn't know the details of what they were working on. And it was through those discussions of Daniel sort of spending an afternoon with me explaining his area of science and the sorts of things that he did on his research career that I started asking him a series of questions. When he couldn't answer them, we were on our first steps of our collaboration.
So what did you do? What was the big question?
Oh, okay. Well, he was showing me the operation of some microfluidic devices where you push liquid through very small channels. And he was describing to me how these devices created large voltage differences from one end of the channel to the other. And I just asked him that if you started to draw current off these devices, in essence, if you started using as a means of generating electricity, what would happen? Would the device just sort of stop working altogether, or what would be the result of that? And he said he was really quite unsure about what that was. So we decided to initiate this research program to characterize that sort of behavior.
What happened then?
Well, I hate to say this, but professors don't actually do anything, you know, sort of physical or whatever. So what we did is we got some graduate students involved, in particular Jun Yang and Fuzi Liu. They had were graduate students of Dr. Kwok's and familiar with some of the electrokinetic side of things. And we gave them pretty free range to investigate whether this would actually happen in the laboratory. And Jun Yang particularly set up an experiment and demonstrated it as a means to convert the energy of flowing liquid directly into electricity.
What has this discovery then meant to your peers in the scientific world?
I think there's been many people who've worked in and around this area for quite some time. There's a process that's exactly opposite to the one that we do, that instead of converting flowing liquid into electricity, you can apply an electric field to liquids and get them to move. And this is called electroosmosis. And there's been many people working in that area. It's a very active area of research. I think some of those people are now starting to look at this electrokinetic power generation. And so I think it is causing a bit of interest in this field and that scientific area.
You said that there's actually quite a history or evolution to get to the point where you are. What is that?
I think the origins of this work date back to the early 1800s when people started noticing at about the same time that scientists were working with all sorts of electrical systems and just sort of getting their brain around electricity and electrical fields and the early work of batteries and of the interaction between magnetism and electricity. People were also observing that when water flowed through porous media, that you did get a voltage difference from one end of a series of channels to the other end. And that work has percolated along in the background and furthered our understanding of the flow and filtration and microfluidics, and up until even as late as the 1960s when a professor Austerlee and one of his graduate students, Frank Morrison, had proposed some of these ideas that they should work and wrote some papers in 1963, 1964 on this very topic. And then, like I say, it sort of died away. No one investigated it for 40-odd years. Seemed to have just fallen off the interest level.
What's next then for you and Dr. Kwok in terms of this?
We continue to work along on ideas that try to improve the efficiencies of these devices. I think one of the reasons that they weren't pursued is that in some original papers that were written about them, they talked about having very, very low efficiencies, sort of sub 1% efficiencies. And that seems to have stuck as a label on these kinds of systems, both for electrokinetic generation of power and electroosmosis. People have been pushing the electroosmosis thing considerably, so now in laboratories there's efficiencies of more like 6%, which is considerably higher, sort of 20 times higher than what people sort of originally thought were available. I guess we're hoping that the same sort of gains can be made on the electrokinetic power generation side. For until you do get those efficiencies up, then I don't think anybody's particularly interested in it, in building an application around it.
Where does this particular process fit into the bigger scheme of things? You look at a lot of things that are going on, for example, with fuel cells right now and even getting them down to the miniature scale. Where would your system fit in?
If you take the big picture of there being a whole series of energy sources, but what humans really want is devices that do work for them, and that can be mechanical work or electrical work. We've created all sorts of devices that allow us to convert between various forms of energy, from thermal energy or chemical energy, like the fuel cell takes that chemical energy directly to electrical work. And other devices take mechanical energy, like a generator takes it from mechanical energy to electrical energy, and motors convert it backwards. I think what this invention sort of puts a focus on is that there's another sort of member of the family of converting between various forms of work and energy. And so where it fits in the scheme of things is that it allows you to convert between flow work. The work that exists in a liquid that's flowing is to be able to convert that directly with no moving parts to electrical energy. And so it just becomes part of the family of devices that people use and exploit based on what energies are available to them and what they want to achieve.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming by.
That was Dr. Larry Kostyuk, professor and chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Alberta. He and Professor Daniel Kwok recently discovered a new way to generate electricity. Their research is supported in part by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Conservation Association, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the Science Alberta Foundation. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.